Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. One of the most interesting places I've ever visited is Yellowstone National Park in Wyoming, which extends into parts of Idaho and Montana. It's an incredible place to view wildlife, waterfalls, and of course its famous geysers. Yellowstone is one of the Earth's most volcanically active places, and on this program we're going to learn more about its volcanic history, the geophysics of its magma chamber, and vast network of hydrothermal features. Our guest and tour guide to volcanism at Yellowstone National Park is Michael Poland. Michael is the scientist in charge for the United States Geological Survey's Yellowstone Volcano Observatory, and he joins us now. Michael Poland, welcome to Blue Dot.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Mike, let's start with your journey. How did you first get interested in geology in general and volcanism specifically? And then, you know, how'd you get to Yellowstone and your gigs? That's a pretty cool title to be the scientist in charge at Yellowstone Volcano Observatory.
It's a fantastic job. I think what started me off on this path was Mount St. Helens. I was a kid living in Northern California in 1980 when the big eruption happened on May 18th. And I just remember consuming that news and the story, reading about it and watching the footage that was coming out of Southwest Washington. And then as I went through elementary school, there was sort of maybe a capitalization on that. And, you know, teachers were talking about volcanoes and geology. And I started to realize, you know, there's a bunch of volcanoes in Northern California that I can go visit. And so my dad and I went camping up at places like Lassen and Shasta and exploring those areas. So I think it just got into me at a young age because of an event. And that's not uncommon among people my age that are in volcanology. We all remember Mount St. Helens.
And then how did you get to Yellowstone?
Luck, I think. You know, I started working in Yellowstone as one of the very first things I did when I got my job with USGS in the very early 2000s. I spent 10 years working in Hawaii, where I picked up a lot of experience in eruption response and monitoring technologies and things like that. Hawaii has always been sort of a training ground for American volcanologists. Less so now than it used to be, because we have now 5 observatories that cover the Cascades, Yellowstone, Alaska, Hawaii, and California. But Hawaii is really where a lot of the action is. So I picked up a lot of skills there. And then when I came back to the Cascades area in 2015, the person that was in charge of the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory was looking to move on to another position. And so I sort of was in the right place at the right time with the skill set that people were looking for. So it was pretty lucky.
Very cool. Okay, well, let's talk about Yellowstone. Let's just get to the basics. It's one of the most volcanic places in the world, but it isn't an obvious volcano. Like you mentioned Lassen Peak and Mount Shasta, Mount St. Helens. You know, you look at those and you go, oh yeah, volcano, it's pretty obvious. But when you go to Yellowstone, it's not quite as obvious, even though there's all the geothermal areas and all that. So talk a little bit about the structure of Yellowstone and what that actually is. It's a caldera. Explain what that is.
Yeah, caldera is a tough concept because it's both a landform and a type of volcano. So a caldera is just a really big crater, several miles across at least. And you find them at the tops of a lot of volcanoes where there have been collapses because, you know, the magma chamber is emptied and then the mountain has basically collapsed in on itself. So the summit of Kilauea and Mauna Loa in Hawaii have calderas at their summits because they're places where the ground has collapsed because of some big eruptions in the past. Crater Lake is kind of not very well named because it's bigger than a crater. It's really a caldera. So there's this expectation, I think, that because Yellowstone is a caldera, there once was a massive mountain there. And I've seen people make weird claims. Oh, yeah, there was a mountain there that was 18,000 feet high or whatever. And that was never the case because a caldera is also a style of volcanism. You can imagine prior to the big caldera forming eruption, Yellowstone was basically a field of volcanism. There were eruptions happening here and there of various types. And eventually, a magma chamber that was really immense built up beneath that system from all of these little eruptions. It was feeding all these little things. It sort of coalesced and had one really large eruption, and the ground collapsed down into the evacuated magma chamber, and that created the depression that's the landform of the caldera. But there was never a huge mountain there. It was really sort of a field of volcanism.
And you know, interesting thing about Yellowstone, and let's talk about the plate tectonic setting of it. And let's compare it to Hawaii, because it's very similar. Like when you look at Hawaii, it's very different from the type of volcanoes we have here in the Cascades, which are caused by subduction, where the oceanic plate is going underneath the continental plate, melting, and then you get this chain of volcanoes, the arc of volcanic mountains. But Hawaii is not like that. It's a mantle plume, correct?
And Hawaii.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, it's something we call a hotspot style of volcanism. And it's in the middle of one of these tectonic plates rather than on the edges like the Cascades are, say. And the mantle plume that you mentioned that's feeding this is something that originates deep within the earth, you know, possibly at the you know, right on the outer part of the core, although that's perhaps somewhat debated. And it's a plume of heat that's rising, not magma, but heat that's rising up towards the surface. And as it gets closer to the surface, it can start some melting. And then that melt punches through the crust and then it'll feed eruptions. And the tectonic plates, meanwhile, are moving. They're all moving relative to one another, which is why you get things like subduction happening off the coast of the Pacific Northwest. But the hotspot is sort of stationary. And so the tectonic plates are moving over the top of what's essentially like a blowtorch beneath them. And that blowtorch is punching through, but the plate's moving around. So it'll create a volcano, and then that volcano will be carried away from the hotspot by the plate motion. So you get this chain of volcanoes that become extinct and get older and older the farther you are from the hotspot.
Which is exactly what you see in Hawaii. You got the big island and then the other islands, and the farther you get from the big island, the older the volcanic features are. And those go into the onto the ocean floor all the way up into Siberia, don't they? The ancient volcanoes that used to be over that hotspot.
If you took away the ocean water from the Pacific, and there are really cool maps you can get that show the bathymetry, the, you know, the ocean floor topography, you will see a chain of mountains that stretch from the Hawaiian Islands, and then there's a little bit of a bend out near Midway and goes all the way up to Kamchatka, Russia. And so that's 60-odd million years of volcanism from the Hawaiian hotspot. It gets older and older the farther you get from Hawaii. And those volcanoes that are, you know, way up by Kamchatka now used to be where, or near where Hawaii is today. So that hotspot's been active for a really long time. And Yellowstone is the same style of volcanism. It's that hotspot.
Question for you.
Yeah, okay.
Yellowstone is the same kind. And I'm sure you're going to tell us that the difference is that it's sitting under a continent instead of an ocean, an oceanic plate. And you can talk about the different kind of crust. But my question for you is, do we see that same kind of evidence of the movement of the plate over the hot spot? In other words, ancient volcanic features, you know, marching away from Yellowstone.
So if you want to test this out or explore this idea for yourself, look at a topographic map of the Northwest or the United States, whatever scale you want, and start at Yellowstone and then sort of look around it and see whether or not there's any weird features. And what you'll notice is that there is a scar in the landscape that sweeps across southern Idaho. It's the Snake River Plain. That is a swath of old volcanoes that get older and older the farther away you get from Yellowstone. So that same track of hotspot volcanism that we see in Hawaii as a trail of little, you know, seamounts that stretch off all the way to Russia, we can see in the Northwest in the scar left by the volcanoes, the volcanic systems that used to dot the Snake River Plain all through Idaho. So yeah, it's there. That trail is there.
So Craters of the Moon National Monument, for example, would that be part of that?
Well, Craters of the Moon, it's a bit younger. And so Craters of the Moon is more modern and is a different style of volcanism. It may have sort of been impacted by the passage of the Yellowstone hotspot, but the old volcanoes from the Yellowstone system, they're all buried now under sediment. I mean, you drive the Snake River Plain now, it's flat. It's a plain in every aspect of that word. And that's because the old calderas that were there, these great big depressions where the ground collapsed into an evacuated magma chamber. They've been filled in by subsequent eruptions and sediment and so forth. But we can see the products of those eruptions in great big ash layers that are spread throughout the region. And if we date them, they get older and older and older until you get back to one of the source calderas of the current part of the track. And that's kind of at the Nevada-Idaho-Oregon border in a place called the McDermott Caldera, which is about 17, 16 million years old. That's the start of the modern Yellowstone hotspot track. It may have gone back a little bit before then. It's difficult to say because the geology is messy, but it really got going at that time at where those three states come together.
Very interesting. Okay. You were about to tell us there's a difference between Hawaiian volcanism, the hotspot there, and the kind of volcanism you get in the center of a continental plate, like North American plate. Explain to us that difference and what it means in terms of eruptive style.
Yeah, Yellowstone and Hawaii are basically the same sort of process. But as you pointed out, the big difference is that Yellowstone is present in a continental setting and Hawaii is an oceanic setting. In the oceanic setting, the crustal plates that make up the surface of the earth are relatively thin, and magma can punch through there without too much of a problem. So you have a lot of eruptive activity, and it's that runny kind of lava that erupts. Its composition is called basalt. It's very fluid. In the continental settings, the crust is very, very thick, and it's much harder for magma to punch its way through. So it stalls on the way up, and it can melt some of the surrounding rock and sort of change composition itself. And you get this composition of magma that is much pastier and thicker. We call it rhyolite, a kind of lava flow that erupts. These lava flows are not runny at all. It's like the difference between honey and toothpaste. And so the lava flows that have erupted at Yellowstone are really, really thick piles of rubble, basically. They don't resemble the kinds of things you've seen on TV that are happening in Hawaii. So the difference is not in the actual process by which these hotspots work. It's really the setting, the oceanic versus the continental setting.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Michael Poland, scientist in charge for the United States Geological Survey's Yellowstone Volcano Observatory. I'm Dave Schloem, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's get back now to our conversation about all things volcanic at Yellowstone National Park with Michael Poland, scientist in charge at the USGS Yellowstone Volcano Observatory. Well, let's talk about the eruptive history of how Yellowstone was created. Can you kind of give us a brief history of the big eruptions in Yellowstone?
So the big caldera-forming eruptions that we have a nice geologic record of started, 16, 17 million years ago, where Idaho, Nevada, and Oregon come together, and they marched across the Snake River Plain as the North American plate moved over the hotspot. Volcanism in the Yellowstone region really got cooking about a little over 2 million years ago. And there was a really immense eruption, one of the largest of the history of the Yellowstone hotspot, that created the Huckleberry Ridge Tuff. Tuff is a name for kind of an ashy volcanic rock. So the Huckleberry Ridge Tuff was the first big caldera-forming event, first huge eruption of the modern Yellowstone volcanic system. There was some more scattered volcanism, and then about 1.3 million years ago, there was the Mesa Falls Tuff that resulted in a smaller caldera. And that caldera is called the Henry's Fork Caldera. It's located sort of in the in the Island Park area of Idaho, southeastern Idaho. And then more scattered volcanism. And then 631,000 years ago, one more really immense eruption. And that was the formation of the Yellowstone Caldera. And it gave us a kind of rock that we call the Lava Creek Tuff. So with these three really large explosive eruptions, the first one, 2.1 million years ago, was the biggest. Smaller one, 1.3 million years ago. And then the medium-sized one that gave us the Yellowstone system we know today about 631,000 years ago. And since that time, there have been a few dozen lava flows that have erupted in Yellowstone caldera itself. And that's one of the reasons that you can't really see a big hole in the ground. anymore, is that it's largely filled.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a bit about the magma chamber. What do we know about the state of it now? Like, is it mostly solidified? What does the magma chambers characterize it for us?
Yeah, mostly solidified is a good way of putting it. We know quite a bit about the magma chamber because we're looking at the speed of seismic waves that pass through that part of the ground. So by looking at seismic waves and how they fast they're moving in various places, you can get a sense of the characteristics of the subsurface. So it's sort of like taking an MRI of the Earth. So in doing that, you know, the early studies recognized, okay, there's something hot down there. And it's probably the magma chamber. It's a few miles deep. It's pretty big. It goes from a few miles to maybe 10 or so miles deep. It is under all of basically the central part of Yellowstone National Park. But just how molten is it? And so that required more data, more advanced methods of processing. And over the years, our picture has become more and more refined. I like to think of it as, you know, when we started out with digital cameras, you're like, hey, I got a 1 megapixel camera, right? You know, that's great. It's hard to really see something with great resolution with something like that, though. Now we've got, you know, 20 megapixel cameras are kind of in our pockets. That's how seismic imaging has evolved. And this greater resolution has allowed us to see the Yellowstone magma chamber in more detail. So we know, yeah, it's mostly solid. It's somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 to 25% molten, but that is not spread out evenly over this huge volume. It seems to be that at the top of the magma chamber, there are these focused lenses. These, we call them sills. They're like little horizontal layers where there's a little bit more melt than the surrounding area. And all of this is known from seismic imaging. So it's pretty amazing technology.
Yeah. What kind of things would it take to change the characteristics of the magma chamber to get it from the solidified state that it's in to starting to, you know, melt more? What kind of factors would create melting? What kind of factors would create that?
You need to rejuvenate it somehow. And the way that these things would typically happen, they would get rejuvenated, would be to have some input of heat to the system. And that is possible. So there is, you know, that's the upper magma chamber at Yellowstone. And that's made of this rhyolite magma, this really sticky, pasty stuff. Below that, so we're talking, you know, 15 miles deep or so, all the way down to maybe 25 miles, 30 miles deep, is another magma system, another magma reservoir. And that's made of that basaltic magma. It's more of a primary product of the melting of the hotspot. And it's sort of the heat engine that drives everything above it. So if there were at some point an input of material from this lower magma chamber, this hotter magma chamber, because basalt tends to be hotter than rhyolite, that could trigger some additional melting. And we do see in the crystal record of past eruptions at Yellowstone that there appear to have been influxes of heat to the system prior to past eruptions. So that's probably the kind of thing you would need in order to kickstart or jumpstart this this kind of stagnant magma body that's beneath the Yellowstone caldera. You'd need some sort of input of heat to keep things going.
And I wonder what would cause that. Like, would it be some, you know, maybe, I'm just thinking out loud here, kind of pulses of heat from deeper within the earth, from, you know, near the core or the deeper mantle, some kind of pulse of heat from there coming up through the system?
Oh, it's probably not driven by something quite that deep, because those processes would be pretty steady and very smeared out over time. It may just be that this lower magma reservoir, you know, the pressure in that gets to a point where it can, you know, squirt a little batch of hotter magma into this, or to the base of this, you know, shallower rhyolite chamber. We don't really know that much about how that works because it's so hidden from us by literally the depths of the earth. And we've never seen anything like that happen. But we have some confidence that we would be able to detect it when it does happen, or if it does happen, because that kind of rejuvenation would be accompanied by seismicity, ground deformation, changes that would be seen at the surface. So that's kind of the sort of thing we watch out for in monitoring Yellowstone.
Well, let's talk about that monitoring. Describe for us, because you monitor the Yellowstone caldera from deep underneath the ground and studying that magma chamber like you described, to all the way up into space. So tell us about how you go about monitoring Yellowstone.
There are so many tools we have in the tool belt for monitoring volcanoes, and we try to apply them all in a place like Yellowstone. We look at seismicity. So there are 46 seismics, or 47, I think now. We installed one a few months ago or last summer. 47 seismic stations in the Yellowstone area that are detecting earthquakes. We have several dozen GPS stations that are looking at how the ground moves. We monitor thermal activity, not only in individual hot springs, but region-wide. We do use satellites. You can see thermal activity from space. You can see ground deformation from space. We also look at water chemistry and gas emissions to see whether or not those compositions are changing over time. So there's no magic tool that will tell us everything we want to know about a volcano. You got to have a really diverse portfolio of tools that you apply when you're studying a volcano. And so that's what we try to do at Yellowstone.
Yeah, you really have to have that complete suite of instrumentation.
Yeah, absolutely.
And GPS is really important too, isn't it?
Yeah, this is actually my kind of specialty. I dedicated my career to studying how the ground moves in volcanic areas and relating that back to what's going on beneath the surface. And GPS is a huge part of that. We're not using the same type of the GPS signal that gets used in phones or in your, you know, handheld GPSs that you might take hiking. We use a different part of the signal that allows us to calculate positions that are good to, you know, a few millimeters. So when the ground, we then take a GPS antenna, we basically stick it in the ground and cement it in place. So when the ground moves by just a few millimeters up or down or in any direction, we can see that in how the antenna is moving. So we can see these really, really subtle movements of the ground pretty much any place. And so GPS has great application for monitoring volcanoes, ground deformation due to earthquakes, subsidence due to, you know, groundwater being pulled out of the ground, you know, anything like that. Anywhere the earth is moving, we can track that using GPS.
And how would you characterize the ground movement that you've observed over the last 10 years? I've you know, you hear all this stuff from various sources that are not exactly valid. I'll just say that, say it that way. Okay. That, oh, you know, sure. the magma chamber is expanding. The ground is rising at Yellowstone.
Yeah.
Can you tell us what's actually going on there?
It cracks me up, some of the things I see. There's for a while, there were these really shady social media sites that were putting out images of, I think they were from the Old Faithful webcam, and they were clearly stretched, like, you know, trees suddenly got really thin in one image versus another. And they were trying to show that the ground had gone up and you could see it in camera images. Well, we have these GPS stations that are on the same hill that they were claiming was going up. And over the time period they were claiming, usually 1 year, they showed that the ground was moving down. So since 2015, the ground at Yellowstone has been subsiding at a rate of about an inch or two per year. But Yellowstone is incredibly dynamic. This is one of the reasons I love working there, is that the place is always changing. So prior to 2015, for a year, 2014 to 2015, Yellowstone went up. From 2010 to 2014, it was going down. From 2004 to 2009, it was going up. Prior to that, it was going down. So Yellowstone is always changing. Sometimes it is rising, sometimes it's falling, but it's always at a rate of about an inch or two per year. And over the last 10 to 15,000 years, we can look at the geologic conditions and see that it has subsided overall by about 100 feet. So long-term, thousands of years, the caldera has gone down, but over short time spans, it rises and falls. And, you know, that's just part of the fascinating story of the place. It's just so active and so dynamic.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's kind of like, it's almost like it's breathing gently.
That's actually the way a couple of geologists have described it, that Yellowstone is breathing. And I think that's apt.
That's cool. That's very cool. Well, you know, we kind of delved into it, so let's talk about it some more. You know, you watch these cable channel, you know, science programs. I hate to even use the word with them. What they think of as science programs, very sensationalistic. And Yellowstone always gets portrayed as the super volcano that will destroy the United States. You know, over the top narration. And then, you know, unfortunately, they'll interview some scientists or, you know, park rangers and people that are responsible people. And, you know, but then they take everything out of context and, you know, weave this, you know, absolutely crazy idea of what's going on. Tell us about what it's like for you as a professional working there to have to deal with that.
It's frustrating. And part of what frustrates me the most is that there seems to be this desire to appeal to that base idea that Yellowstone has had very large volcanic eruptions, absolutely true, and it's going to have them in the future. Maybe. We actually don't know. You know, the magmatic system may be slowing down, and it's possible that it won't have another major explosive eruption. It may be nearing the end of its life. We don't really know. But this idea that someday it's going to happen and it's going to wipe out all life on Earth, frankly, I think it's a bit lazy. Yellowstone is incredible, right? You go there, the geologic story that is being told, not only by the rocks, but by the fact that there's hot water shooting out of the ground all over the place. There's more geysers there than any place else on Earth by a lot. It's a fascinating story all by itself. And I just don't feel like you need to appeal to this kind of, you know, scare tactic. Please watch this because we're going to tell you about the doom of humanity. And meanwhile, you're missing one of the most spectacular places on Earth. I just find it a little bit silly, some of these, the way that some of these programs approach Yellowstone. But you see it everywhere, not just in, you know, these, some of these documentaries, but also everywhere online.
YouTube channels.
Social media. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There are some good ones too on YouTube. There are some good geology channels, but they probably don't get the number of views that the sensational ones do.
I think that it's, you know, if you're going to choose something to click on, you know, you can click on one that says, hey, Yellowstone has cool geology. And then it says, Yellowstone one day is going to kill you. Then, you know, most people go for the latter, unfortunately, even though, I mean, I'm biased, right? I'm a geologist. I really love this stuff. But I think it's pretty easy to love Yellowstone in general. There's just no place like it on Earth.
And I agree with you. It's got enough beauty and mystery and just an incredible natural history. And it's on its own without sensationalizing it.
Yeah.
You don't need to do that. It's got plenty there for you.
That's exactly the way I feel. You just don't need to try to make Yellowstone more spectacular than it already is.
Okay, well, let's talk about those geothermal areas because, as you said, there, you know, you've got the most geysers anywhere on the planet there. Let's just go through some basic definitions. Let's define what some of these things are. So you have geysers and hot springs.
Yeah.
You have mud pots and fumaroles. So let's go through those and describe what are the differences. Like, for example, what's a fumarole?
Well, a fumarole is a gas vent. So there's no water shooting out of the ground there. It's a place where gas that's perhaps ultimately from that cooling magma body beneath Yellowstone, as it puts off gases, they sort of migrate through the crust. They pick up different compositions and change a little bit chemically as they rise. And they manage to reach the surface without getting dissolved in water or anything like that. And then you get a gas vent, which we call a fumarole. In some places, these fumaroles may be interacting with groundwater or surface water. And that's where you can get some mud pots. So really some of the famous boiling mud and mud volcanoes, those are sort of places where gases and near surface water are interacting. But in places where it's hot water, that's really the key the key aspect of the system, you see hot springs and geysers. And the geysers are places where there's a constriction of some sort and a lot of boiling water. And that boiling water backs up behind the constriction, steam pressure builds up, and then you can get geyser eruption. Sometimes this happens regularly at places like Old Faithful. A lot of places it happens randomly. And then hot springs are more open systems where there may not be those sorts of constrictions and water can just sort of circulate through, sort of like a pot on a stove.
And is Old Faithful still kind of on the same schedule it used to be? What's going on with Old Faithful these days?
It is, although it's changed over the years. Every now and then I see some weird claims that Old Faithful is no longer faithful, and I have no idea where those come from because it's perfectly faithful. It erupts now about every 94 minutes, give or take. It's not like clockwork. It will vary depending on the characteristics of the previous eruption. And occasionally there will be a very small eruption And that might mean that the next eruption is going to be quicker than normal, than average. Or sometimes it may be a little longer than average because perhaps the previous eruption was much, much larger. I'm sorry, I can't remember the question.
I just wanted to know how Old Faithful is doing.
Oh, yes, sorry. But this is, sorry. But Old Faithful's overall average time between eruptions, it has changed over the years. It was really first well documented in the 1870s. And then it erupted about once per hour. And that was true all the way up through about 1959. And in 59, there was a very large earthquake just to the west of the park, the Hebgen Lake earthquake. It was a magnitude 7.3. It was a tectonic event, so not related to the volcano, but all of that shaking rattled the hydrothermal system. I think of the Yellowstone hydrothermal system as being like the plumbing in an old house. And maybe this is because I live in an old house. And you know, if I were to grab the pipes in my basement and shake them really hard, there'd be leaks everywhere. And that's kind of what happened in 1959. And there were subsequent earthquakes that continued to rattle the area. Like 1983, there was an earthquake in Idaho that affected some of the geyser systems. And because of these events, Old Faithful has gotten more time between eruptions. And so now it is that, you know, about an hour and a half or so. But it still erupts very, very regularly every 94 minutes. It's just been kind of smeared out, especially since about 1959. Due to all the seismic activity and so forth in the region.
That's interesting, because I remember reading about that earthquake. It happened the year I was born, 1959, it was a big one. It's interesting to think about how that affected, you know, the Yellowstone plumbing system, like you said.
Yeah, it was the largest, still is, the largest earthquake ever recorded in the Intermountain West. And there is the potential for that to happen again. I think that's an underappreciated hazard in the Yellowstone region. And people tend to focus on, hey, there's the big volcanic system, and you know, we know it's going to be the doom of our kind. And they miss the fact that magnitude 6 and 7 earthquakes are very likely in that region. And we had the 7.3 in 1959. There was a magnitude 6 in 1975 in the park. So that kind of magnitude of earthquake can and will happen again. They happen on human timescales. They won't cause the volcano to erupt. That's a common question I get asked is, you know, will the next magnitude 9 off the Pacific Northwest or something like that trigger an eruption of Yellowstone? That's not the way it works. You'd have to have a volcano that was very, very close to erupting anyway in order to be spurred like that. And Yellowstone clearly is nowhere near erupting. And, you know, that 7.3 is sort of evidence that that earthquake happened right next to the magma chamber underground. And it rattled those hot water plumbing systems, but that was it.
And you know, there are a lot of active faults in that region. You've got mountains like the Grand Tetons there for a reason. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. When you see mountain ranges like that, really rugged young mountains, there are faults that are associated with those mountains. There's a huge fault at the base of the Tetons. So yeah, all through the area. In fact, basically the entire area from, you know, western Montana and Wyoming all the way out to the Sierra Nevada, you see these young mountain ranges, and there are faults associated with every one of them. So this is part of the reason that the western U.S. is such an active place in terms of earthquakes.
Okay, back to our geothermal areas. Something I saw was very interesting is that there was a study, I think it was a few years ago, of bison carcasses. Where, you know, mm-hmm. you find those, and could you talk a little bit about, you know, the role that bison carcasses play in understanding what's going on with the geothermal system?
I think you're probably referring to this discovery, I think it was in 2003 or 2004, of a number of dead bison. And I think that was near the Norris Geyser Basin. And they didn't have any marks on them. It was just a number of, they hadn't been, you know, killed by predators or, you know, anything like that. And the conclusion there was that they were in a low area, sort of a little swale, and it was in winter. It was very cold. There was sort of an inversion layer that formed, and carbon dioxide gas, which is part of what's released by any magmatic system, had built up in that low area because it's heavier than normal air. And basically, the bison were asphyxiated. And this happens from time to time. There's another spot that's over on the east side of the park that was given the name in the early 1900s of Death Gulch. It's a low point, and there were several dead bears found in there. And the thought is that it was in low area. Some carbon dioxide accumulated in that area during time period when there was an inversion layer that didn't permit for much mixing. There was no wind or anything like that. And some animals went in there and died. And then, you know, bears saw, oh, there's a free meal, went down there, were overcome and asphyxiated. And other bears came. So there were a number of carcasses in that area. That's part of the consequence of the gases that are being released by the system.
So lesson learned, if you want to take a nap somewhere around the geothermal systems, go to a hill, go to a high spot.
Yeah.
Don't take a nap down in the lower lying areas.
The valleys are, especially if there's no wind and it's very cold. And yeah, that's the valleys are not the best places.
I know that people have been killed here in California near Mammoth Lakes from the same kind of thing, where carbon dioxide seeping out of the ground and they don't realize it and sit down to have a sandwich. And the next thing you know, they feel a little headachy and lay down and that kills them. Okay, you recently had quite an event in the park, a hydrothermal explosion in Biscuit Basin. Tell us about what happened there.
That was quite the event. So in that case, it was not driven by, for example, magma that suddenly came into contact with groundwater and caused that water to flash to steam. This is sort of a pretty common misconception. We've gotten a lot of questions about that. Does this mean that magma is really, really shallow? What happened there was that you had a bunch of water that was already boiling and it got confined. So you can kind of think of it as like a pressure cooker or Instapot situation where you had a bunch of boiling water that was confined, and then something cracked, something broke open, and that container that was holding that boiling water suddenly ruptured. And so it was like you popped open the Instapot or the radiator in the car or the pressure cooker, and an explosion ensued because that boiling water flashed to steam and drove a pretty impressive explosion that was very, very well witnessed. That kind of thing is actually not uncommon in Yellowstone. It happens probably, that size may happen once every decade or so. But smaller events like that happen multiple times a year somewhere in Yellowstone. In fact, there was one that was impressive enough that happened just a few months before, but it occurred in an area of the park that was closed because it's transition between seasons in Yellowstone. And it went largely unnoticed, except that we found the crater and we saw it in monitoring data. So that's what happened back on July 23rd is a consequence. It's a function of this very active boiling water hydrothermal system. It's the most common hazard in Yellowstone. I would have said prior to July 23rd, it was the most underappreciated, but with all that amazing viral video that came out, maybe it's not quite so underappreciated now.
Let's take a short break, but be sure to stay with us as we continue our look at the Yellowstone supervolcano with Michael Poland, scientist in charge for the United States Geological Survey's Yellowstone Volcano Observatory. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our visit with Michael Poland, scientist in charge for the USGS Yellowstone Volcano Observatory. Let's talk about, you know, visitors to these areas, because Yellowstone is one of the, you know, most visited parks in the United States. Mm. There are a lot of hazards associated with these geothermal areas. It's not Disneyland. Those boardwalks are there for a reason. Talk about just the hazards that they present to visitors and how to avoid getting hurt.
Well, the ground in many parts of Yellowstone in these thermal areas is boiling. The ground itself is just beneath the surface at boiling temperatures. And in many places, there is boiling water just beneath the surface. And there's a relatively thin crust that is above that either boiling water or very, very hot steam, you know, effectively boiling temperature steam. And so this is why the boardwalks are so critical, that you need to be sticking to those boardwalks because they're built in areas that avoid the thin crust and all of the boiling ground. There have been incidents where people have gone off boardwalk and have accidentally broken through this crust and gotten badly burned. And some people have unfortunately been killed in those sorts of encounters with the boiling water. So there's sort of a, I think there's some people that think that they're going to try out a, you know, a hot spring as a place that they can go for a soak. And they just don't understand that it's boiling water. You know, it may not look like it's boiling. It may look calm and blue and inviting, but you know, if you immerse yourself in boiling water, your chances of survival are not good.
Well, and it's not just the thermal aspects too. There's chemical aspects to those waters, depending on where you are, that even if it wasn't boiling, that water's not good for your skin.
Yeah, it's not great. Now, it's not as acidic as some people might think. I've seen a lot of misconceptions that, you know, if you, you know, stick your hand in a hot spring at Yellowstone, the acid will burn you. And I think this, you know, may come from, you know, there are some movies that, you know, showed lakes near volcanoes, and you jump into them, your skin just starts to burn off. And it doesn't work that way. The acidity is sort of, in some places, maybe like that of orange juice or, you know, but it's still not great. Even the stuff that's not boiling, you know, can be an irritant. And there is a lot of nasty stuff that can come out of these hydrothermal areas and end up in some of the rivers. So you can swim in some of the Yellowstone rivers. In some areas, they have areas that are designated for swimming, but the park recommends, you know, don't drink the water, you know, try not to inhale a bunch of water or anything like that. You'll get into your system because, you know, it's not pure mountain spring water. It's got some nasty stuff in it.
And another interesting aspect of those hot spring areas is there are things that do live in them. The extremophile bacteria and things. Those are really interesting. Could you just talk about those a little bit?
Yeah, this is maybe an analog for how life originated on Earth. You know, there's a fair amount of research that suggests that it's kind of hot springs where, you know, the ingredients for life existed long, long ago. And that's where it got started. And so Yellowstone is a bit of a wonderland, not just for geologists, but for biologists, for people that are studying these bacteria. And the stories of some of these bacteria are just incredible. The one that I think is the most amazing is that in the mid to late 60s, there was a scientist named Thomas Brock, and he went and sampled some bacteria without a specific real reason or goal for sampling the bacteria other than to understand what it was. And that bacteria ended up leading to a Nobel Prize for some folks that figured out how they could use something that's in the bacteria to replicate DNA. And ultimately, that became the basis for the PCR testing that has been used, for example, to detect COVID. That all originated from bacteria in a Yellowstone hot spring that was sampled, you know, almost 60 years ago.
Oh, that's fascinating. That always amazes me to think when I look at these hot springs, because I have them here near me in Lassen Volcanic National Park, mm-hmm. you know, to think about things living in that acidic, because the water here is pretty acidic, acidic water, very hot, and yet these things thrive in it. It's just amazing.
Yeah, the ability of life to... Yeah, as you said, not just survive, but to thrive in such an environment is incredible. There's obviously a lot to learn from that.
And another interesting thing about, you know, visitors coming to the park is, do you get to do a lot of education for folks and teach them about the geology and do, like, you know, or do you help train the rangers to do geology talks, for example?
That's one of the most enjoyable parts of the job is interacting with people. I do get to spend a lot of time interacting with not just the interpreters that work for the park, but also a lot of the guides that take people into the park from outside. I've had a lot of amazing conversations with them, and they're incredibly observant, you know, because they're there every day taking people around, and they notice, hey, you know, this particular steam vent became more active or less active, or notice some new feature. And so I've learned a lot by talking to them. But then I also have these great interactions with the public. If I'm in the park, you know, doing some field work or taking some geophysical measurements or, you know, looking around a geyser basin, I have really wonderful conversations with people that are interested in what they're seeing. I think once you're there, you can't help but be fascinated by what's around you. It's so magnificent and so spectacular and so difficult to fathom that I think it's hard not to be just instantly engaged by the landscape you're in.
And there's such a vast area of Yellowstone. It's a big park, and you know, away from the roads and in the backcountry. Are there places where you're still learning about them? As far as like, oh, you know, we didn't realize there's a hot spot, you know, way out there. How do you go about like monitoring, you know, kind of like warm areas in the park, as it were?
Well, a big part of that is from satellite monitoring, and there's a couple of neat recent applications of how that's helped us. One is that we've discovered existing thermal areas that we didn't know about by looking at high resolution satellite images. These are mostly visible images, so really just pictures from space. But we can see areas of the backcountry during winter where there are little patches where no snow accumulates. It's snow everywhere else, but there's little patches where there's no snow. Why wouldn't there be snow? Well, it's because the ground is warm. When you walk out there, it's very difficult to say, oh yeah, this is a thermal area, because you know, you may not see the telltale ground signs or steam emissions or anything like that, because it's warm ground. It's not boiling ground. But when you use the satellite data, suddenly it becomes pretty clear. So our catalog and the resolution of our catalog of these thermal areas is becoming better and better with time, the more of the satellite data we have access to and we look at. The other thing that we've been able to see happen, starting off thanks to satellite data, is the birth of a new thermal area. Now, this happened in the eastern part of the park. It's way off trail, so it's not in an area that people would frequent. But one of the scientists that was looking at thermal data noticed there was a thermal anomaly, and it didn't correlate with any known thermal area. So this is something that wasn't in our database of hot ground. And he started exploring air photos of the area, and in the late 90s, the area was just forest. And then in the 2000s, it looked like some of the trees weren't doing so well. And in the late 2000s, some of the trees were dead. And by the mid 2010s, the trees were down and the ground had that white, chalky, telltale appearance of a thermal area. We went out there, checked it out. Sure enough, it was boiling just beneath the surface. There were gas vents that were putting sulfur out. So we caught in the act the formation of a new thermal area thanks to satellite data. Probably happens pretty regularly in Yellowstone, maybe every few decades or so. But only recently have we had the technology to be able to detect something like this.
Wow, that's really cool. That's a great detective story.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, we caught it in the act and we're able to document it and go out and see kind of Yellowstone's, what we think is Yellowstone's youngest thermal area. By studying this, we can now hope to better understand how some of these other thermal areas have evolved. We see some that are kind of in their waning phases. They're clearly were hot at one point and now they're cold. And so that kind of helps us understand how these things, you know, the tail end of their life cycle, basically. Now we've caught one at the beginning of its life cycle. And so we're starting to be able to put together stories of how thermal areas in Yellowstone are born, go through their lives, and then wane, die off.
You mentioned one of my favorite places in the park, Mammoth Hot Springs, and those magnificent travertine terraces. Can you tell us about, because those are pretty rare to see that are still, you know, have hot water. I know of places I can go near me in California here, in the Feather River Canyon, for example, where I can see travertine, but there's no hot water there anymore. They were formed long ago. Tell us about those, because those are really cool looking.
Yeah, they are spectacular, aren't they? I love Mammoth as well. The formations there are gorgeous. That particular style of hot spring it's not rare in Yellowstone, but it's not the most common form of hot spring. And that's because the waters there are traveling through geology that includes a bunch of limestone and places where you can pick up calcium. These were geologic units that were laid down when the Yellowstone area was the bottom of a shallow sea, you know, tens of millions of years ago. And it sort of dissolves that stuff and brings it up to the surface. And as it gets to the surface and cools and some of the gas is released by the water, that stuff drops out and it gives you these calcium rich layers that form the terraces of Mammoth Hot Springs. There's a couple of places where you can find that in Yellowstone. the water there is a bit cooler because it's farther from the real source of heat. So there's no boiling water at Mammoth, but it's still enough to dissolve some of the chemical, the elements, you know, beneath the ground in those geologic units and bring them to the surface.
Well, Michael Poland, scientist in charge for the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory, thanks for joining us and sharing your passion and your knowledge about just one of the most amazing places on the planet.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for a good conversation.
Thanks again to our guest, Michael Poland, scientist in charge for the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory. You can learn more about their work and volcanic nature of Yellowstone at usgs.gov/observatories/YVO. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, service of Cap Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.